Luke 1:46-1:66, the eighth talk in a series on the Gospel of Luke, was presented by Jack Crabtree on February 1, 2004 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc. 2004. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
Forgive me if I get a little repetitious here. I get so embroiled in this stuff, I sometimes forget what I have talked to you about and what I haven't talked to you about. So there may be a few things that I mentioned that I already talked about last week, but sorry about that. We're in my translation on page 3, we're on paragraph 17. This is chapter 1, verse 46 in your real Bibles. And Mary said, just to give you background here, remember the angel Gabriel has come to both Elizabeth and to Mary earlier in the chapter and announced the respective birth of their children, John the Baptist and Jesus, and has made some predictions about them, about who these children are going to be. Mary has been told by the angel Gabriel that Elizabeth is pregnant, so Mary travels from Nazareth to the hill country of Judah where Elizabeth lives and goes to her home, and there's this encounter between the two of them where Mary and Elizabeth greet each other, and Elizabeth has a kind of prophetic claim to make, and Mary makes a sort of prophetic statement. I do want to clear up one thing. Ron pointed out to me where I unfortunately was being very unclear. We've been talking about, we see several times here in this chapter, Elizabeth is filled with the Holy Spirit, Mary is filled with the Holy Spirit, Zacharias later in the chapter, we haven't got there yet, is going to be filled with the Holy Spirit and prophesies. And in order, I was trying to make clear the distinction between being filled with the Holy Spirit, even though that language is never used for this purpose, but we could conceive of being filled with the Holy Spirit as being a process whereby someone receives some kind of special revelation. So the Spirit comes along and basically gives us the words that we are to say on behalf of God. That's the kind of thing you see in the Old Testament prophets, Isaiah, Jeremiah, and those people, and the minor prophets, where the word of the Lord came upon them, or the burden of the Lord came upon them, or the oracle of the Lord came to them. And then they speak, and oftentimes, not always, but oftentimes, the actual speaking is as if it's from the mouth of God himself. Thus saith the Lord. And then it's God speaking from his point of view, from his perspective. Well, that's special revelation in the sense that we're typically accustomed to thinking of it. And the point I was trying to make is that that's not what we're getting here, I don't believe. That what Mary, Elizabeth, and Zacharias are saying is information that's directly available to them through the scriptures that they have studied and through the common understanding that they would have held in some sort of subculture of Judaism of this day. They knew the scriptures, they had interpreted the scriptures, they had a take on the scriptures, and they're speaking out of that understanding of the scriptures. And everything that they're saying is consonant with that. It's not like new revelation that they're receiving. Except for, the only thing that's new is the part that has been given them by the angel Gabriel, who said, your son is the one, your son is the one. And that's special revelation, but that's already come to them through the message of the angel Gabriel. So in order to make a distinction between special revelation in that sense and what's going on here, is I tried to emphasize the role of the Spirit to bring clarity to us, to work in us subjectively, to give us the, as Jesus would call it, the eyes to see and the ears to hear, to work against the resistance in us, the hatred of God, the hatred of truth that's naturally in us, that is a barrier to our understanding and is a barrier to clarity in us, and to dissolve that so that there is clarity. What I took for granted that I didn't make clear is in this chapter of Luke, when Mary is filled with the Spirit, when Elizabeth is filled with the Spirit, when Zacharias is filled with the Spirit and prophesies, I think Luke is trying to emphasize a moment in time where there's an episode of clarity brought about by the Spirit of God, an episode of clarity that gives real significance to what they utter at that time, the statements that they make. So Luke is highlighting their statements. What Mary said to Elizabeth and what Elizabeth says to Mary, what Zacharias is going to say later, these are incredibly important and significant statements because they're at a moment of supernaturally given clarity. What I'm saying by that is Mary, Elizabeth, and Zacharias may not have been this clear the next day. You know, we see even in the disciples of Jesus where they have moments of clarity, but then the confusion comes flooding back in later. So this being filled with the Spirit here is not a state of being. It is an occasion upon which they said something that was born of the Spirit, if you will. And that's what I was intending to say all along, but I think I misled you by my emphasis on the role of the Spirit in sanctifying us. I led you with the impression that all Luke is saying here is that these are sanctified people. No, it's more than that. Yes, they are being sanctified, but what's important to Luke is what they say here, not who they are as people. I hope that's clear now. Okay, so Mary, in a moment of supernatural clarity, in an episode of supernatural clarity, has said, starting with paragraph 17, and Mary said, "My soul perceives the greatness of the Lord. My spirit is made joyful because of God, my deliverer, because he has cast his eye upon the lowly condition of his bondservant. Behold, then, from now on, all generations will consider me fortunate, for the Mighty One has done great things for me. Surely is his name holy. Indeed, his faithfulness extends from generations to generations for the sake of those who fear him. With his arm he has exhibited power. He has scattered abroad those who thought they were important in the outlook of their hearts. He has brought down rulers from their thrones and exalted the lowly. He has filled the hungry with good things and sent the rich away empty-handed. In accord with what he told our fathers, he has made Israel his servant, in remembrance of his faithfulness to Abraham and his descendants to the end of time." Mary stayed with her about 3 months, then she returned to her own home. Okay, let's talk about that. I think I already mentioned, surely is his name holy, and I think that's just sort of an idiomatic way of saying the one whose name is Yahweh is a holy being, is a holy dude. God, Yahweh, who has that name, the one who has that name is holy. I don't think he's talking about the holiness of the name per se, but the holiness of the person bearing the name. Now, holy, I don't think I talked about this. I hope I didn't. As best I can tell, in my judgment, the root idea behind the word holy and where that comes from is, you know, if you've ever been in a situation where you are just so incredibly overcome and struck by the grandeur and majesty in something that you kind of get a shiver that overcomes you, or you get this sort of spooked feeling because you're in the presence of something so much more majestic, so much bigger, so much more powerful, so much more something than you are. And it actually brings about a sort of a visceral response in you. You just can't help but kind of shudder at the prospect that you are so small and insignificant and something else is so big and so powerful and so significant. Think when there's something that creates that kind of visceral response, it is holy. I mean, that's the basic idea, I think, of holiness. And of course, we're attaching it to the divine. We're seeing it as something, the divine breaking through into our experience. God is holy for all kinds of different reasons. I mean, so basically the underlying reason or the underlying concept of holy, I think, is someone is holy if they are particularly and especially awesome in some respect. There's something about them that's awesome. Well, in that regard, the one who bears the name Yahweh is awesome in many, many respects. His wisdom is awesome. His power is awesome. His creativity is awesome. The beauty that he is capable of creating is awesome. I mean, that just everywhere you turn, you are confronted by the nature of God being awesome in all kinds of respects. Mary here has one particular thing in mind, I think, and she goes on to tell us what that is. Surely is his name holy. Indeed, his faithfulness extends for generations and generations for the sake of those who fear him. It's what I have translated his faithfulness that Mary is just awestruck by. He's not just faithful, he's faithful to awesome proportions and to an awesome degree. Now, what is she talking about? If you look at a normal English translation, they probably translate that mercy rather than faithfulness, and so I need to talk about that for a second, explain that. The Greek word here is eleos, which in certain contexts, in many contexts, could legitimately be translated mercy. What our English translations do is they translate that Greek word mercy everywhere they see it. So in a situation like this, they translate it mercy because they just always translate that mercy. The problem is, eleos is a word that gets used in the Greek translation of the Hebrew Old Testament, the translation we call the Septuagint. In the Greek translation of the Hebrew Old Testament, whenever the Hebrew word chesed occurs, almost always it's translated by the Greek word eleos, this word that we sometimes translate mercy, often translate mercy. The Hebrew concept chesed, we've probably talked about that before, but it's an important idea. It's hard to translate. It's sort of virtually impossible to translate. But I've translated it faithfulness as kind of a placeholder for what the Hebrew word chesed means. Chesed has to do with the character of God, the nature of God, as someone who doggedly and relentlessly keeps his covenants and his promises. He does us the kindness. He is compassionate in a way, and I think that's where it overlaps with the word mercy. He's a compassionate God who, out of that compassion, will never fail to do what he said he's going to do. So if he made a covenant, he's going to keep the covenant. Against all obstacles, he's going to do what he said he's going to do. That's what Mary is looking at here. Right, okay, so I'm going to use the word faithfulness as just a placeholder for that word, and it may not actually adequately capture everything that the Hebrew word means, but I think the Greek word is being used as a placeholder for chesed, and I'm going to use the English word faithfulness for a placeholder for chesed, but it's good to try to teach yourself the concept of the chesed of God and just keep that as a conceptual tool that you have in studying the Bible. Mary's impressed that God's chesed extends for generations and generations. That's how awesome his chesed is. I mean, just think of your own experience, where if we made a promise to someone, sooner or later, I mean, to my shame, I'm aware of all kinds of promises that I have made in my life that have just sort of evaporated through time. You know, once your promise gets old enough, it sort of seems to become totally invalid, right? Well, yes, I promised it, but that was 25 years ago. That's how fickle and faithless we are. But the incredible thing about God is for thousands and thousands and thousands of years, God, who made a promise multi-thousands of years ago, is still tenaciously, doggedly, relentlessly pursuing, making sure that that promise comes about. And what Mary is recognizing is, in the birth of her child, God is actually acting now to take the next step, the next important step, toward keeping the promise that he made. What are we talking about? 5,000? No, sorry, that's us. 3,000 years earlier? More than 3,000 years earlier? I don't even know if that's right. But anyway, thousands of years ago. And Mary is recognizing now, God, now, you're going to begin to bring to pass, put in place what needs to be put in place in order that your promise to our father Abraham could be kept. And she is understandably awestruck by that. This is just incredible. That any being would be that faithful, that loyal, that that much a person of their word that he's going to keep his word now. And that's why she breaks out in, your name is holy. Surely is your name holy, for your hesed extends for generation upon generation upon generation for the sake of those who fear him. Now, interesting that she adds that, for the sake of those who fear him. Really, basically, the hesed of God is completely and utterly irrelevant to the rest of mankind. It's only those of us who have a certain perspective on God who would even take any interest in the character of God in this respect and what it is that he's beginning to do with the birth of Jesus. Mary, I think, recognizes that. There are all kinds of people in the world, in fact, most of the human race, who could care less whether God keeps his promises or not, because his promises are frankly not particularly interesting to them. You know, God can go over there and play with history however he wants to. I'm concerned about me. I'm concerned about my life and my life now. Is it comfortable? Is it convenient? Do I have enough happiness in my life right now? I mean, that's the thing that's of concern to me. And the thing that we see throughout this chapter that is very noteworthy and very remarkable is how different the attitude of these people is from the attitude that we are so naturally disposed to. Namely, to look at myself as the center of the universe and to see God as my servant. And the only question for most of mankind is, how good of a servant is God? Does he take care of me and do good to me, or does he not take care of me and do good to me? But the perspective of Mary and Zacharias and Elizabeth, their perspective is, this is cool. God is about to do what he promised our father Abraham thousands and thousands of years ago. He really is there. He really is in control of history. He really intended to do what he said he intended to do. This is for real. This is really happening. And that is valuable to them and significant to them. So, they're the model for us. We need to be not among the people in mankind who are so preoccupied with our own situation, who are the centers of our own little universe, who see God as totally irrelevant for any other reason other than to serve us and to meet our needs. And we need to take our seat among the creatures in the world as just one more being made by God to serve him and to accomplish his purposes, and to be what he wants us to be. So that's the overwhelming lesson of the attitudes of the people in this first chapter here. So we need to be among those who fear him. I won't expound on that. Ron spoke on the fear of God Tuesday night at McKinsey Study Center, and I recommend you get that tape. That was an excellent exposition of what it means to fear God. Basically, in a nutshell, we either fear God or we fear man. And what it comes down to is, who are you impressed with? Who do you want to impress? I mean, who is it whose relationship concerns you? We're either going to be mostly concerned with our relationship with God and our standing before God and our status in God's eyes, or we're going to be preoccupied with our standing and status and relationship to other people. And the overwhelming message of the Bible is, if you're preoccupied with your relationship with other people, you're a fool. They don't really have a lot of authority and power to do much for you or to you of any consequence. But God holds all the power and all the authority, and you need to acknowledge that power and authority and the significance of what he can do to you and be concerned about your relationship with God. You need to fear him, not man. Well, Mary goes on to explain what it is that has been announced is going to happen. With his arm, he has exhibited power. And I think with his arm, he's exhibited power is basically the equivalent of our idiom, he's flexed his muscles. God has flexed his muscles, which is to say God has acted. God has now proactively taken action. With his arm, he has exhibited power. Now she goes on to explain what the action he has taken. He has scattered abroad those who thought they were important in the outlook of their hearts. He has brought down rulers from their thrones and exalted the lowly. Those are mutually interpretive, so I'll take those together. what she has in mind here, I think, are those who think that they are important in the outlook of their hearts are the Roman rulers of her day. Caesar, Caesar's governors, King Herod, all the people who owe their power and their authority to Rome and it derives from Rome. These are people who really don't have a clear perspective of their own importance. There's a bit of a hubris among them. They think of themselves as mighty when in fact they're nothing but pawns in God's game. And they don't get it. They don't understand that. So accordingly, they think of themselves as much more important than they are. And a lot of their arrogance comes from the fact that they are ruling over the people of God, the seed of Abraham, the people of Israel. They're ruling over Israel, and they don't even understand that they have no right to rule over Israel. The only rightful ruler of Israel is God and his appointed representative, his son, Jesus. The only rightful ruler. And to the extent that they have usurped that authority at this point in history and are presuming to be leaders over the king, over the people of Israel, in doing so, they have set themselves up against God and his purposes and against his people. Later, Zacharias is going to describe that as they have hated the people of God in the next statement that gets made. Well, with the birth of Jesus, Mary says, that's going to be the end of their pretense. That's going to be the end of their pretended authority and pretended power. Because God has now appointed his king, his ruler, the one who will rule over his people. And Mary is simply extrapolating here. He will, of course, have to depose the Roman rulers in order to rule. So that being the case, the birth of this child is the beginning of the end of Rome. She says this in such a way. Remember, she said, indeed, his faithfulness extends for generations and generations for the sake of those who fear him. I think Mary seems to be very well aware that this is not a unique event in the history of the people of Israel. This is just one more in a series of events where God has brought down those people who, in the thoughts of their hearts, in the outlook of their hearts, thought that they were important. The Persians were brought, the Babylonians were brought down. The Persians after them were brought down. The Greeks after them were brought down. All the pretenders to the throne of the rule over the people of God have sooner or later been scattered abroad and brought down. But what Mary has in mind in particular here is the birth of Jesus, where with the birth of Jesus, the lowly now are being exalted. And what does she mean? I think she means the people of Israel. Those are the lowly, as opposed to the rich and powerful Romans. The people of, they're going to be brought low, but the lowly people of Israel are going to be brought high. Why lowly? They are a client government. They are subservient to Rome. They're under the thumb of Rome. They're oppressed by Rome. They can't offer an offering to God without the permission of the emperor. And they realize how much they lack freedom to pursue their covenant with their God the way that covenant was created in the time of Moses. They don't have the freedom to do that. They can't sneeze without Rome telling them they can sneeze. So they're under their thumb and they're oppressed. And economically they are burdened. The taxation at this time was incredibly crushing, and it kept them all at a basic, fundamentally a level of poverty. There were very few well-off people among the Jews. They were basically reduced to subsistence level by the taxation of Rome. But Mary is seeing with the birth of Jesus, that can be changed. The lowly will be exalted. He has filled the hungry with good things and sent the rich away empty-handed. Again, the good things that the hungry are being filled with are the blessings promised by the covenant of Moses. She's seen this is now, it's possible now that this can be brought to pass. And so we who are hungry for the blessings of God, now, finally, we can receive those blessings and we will be filled up. We will be made full and our hunger will be sated. Whereas the rich, again, the Romans, I think, and anyone like them who would presume to rule over the people of God, will be sent away empty-handed. None of this stuff that God has promised to the people of Israel will come to them. It's not their blessings, and so they will go without. In accord with what he told our fathers, he has made Israel his servant in remembrance of his faithfulness to Abraham and his descendants to the end of time. So she explicitly connects what is happening with the birth of Jesus to the promise that he made to our fathers, he says, and that's Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob primarily. He has made Israel his servant in remembrance of his faithfulness to Abraham and his descendants to the end of time. I've translated it faithfulness again, but it's the Greek word eleos, standing for the Hebrew word chesed. So one more time, we run into the chesed of God, the faithfulness of God to keep his promises and his covenants. Well, if you remember back the story of Abraham, God came to Abraham and the basic fundamental promise he made to him, well, two basic fundamental promises. Abraham, I will bless you, and in you all the nations of the earth will be blessed, on the one hand, and then the other part of the promise, Abraham, with respect to your seed, I will be their God, and they will be my people. So way back, going back to the beginning of these people as a people, the promise that was made to them is, I am going to have a unique relationship with you as a people, such that I will be your God, and you will be my people. Now, what's going on here? We're going to see this in Mary's comment here, and we're going to see it even more strongly in Zechariah's comment coming up. Apparently, there were a number of people at this time, or at least a handful of people at this time, who were fairly diligent students of the Old Testament scriptures, and I think very intelligent students of the Old Testament scriptures, who've put the pieces together into a coherent picture. When we read the Old Testament, I mean, I've been a Bible student for many, many years now, and it wasn't until very recently that I was able to see what I think Mary sees here. When we read the Old Testament, I mean, you remember, the Old Testament is a long book. It's got a lot of stuff in it. It's got a lot of passages that are relatively tedious and boring, and they're pretty, and some of the important stuff is pretty far apart. It's very, very difficult to get a kind of sweeping, coherent picture of what's going on in the Old Testament. You really have to be attentive. You really have to be motivated to create that picture for yourself before you're going to get it. If you're not motivated, you're not going to see it because it's not real visible. But apparently, they have been diligent, and they have recognized some important things, and that is that there's a connection between the promise that God made to Abraham, the covenant that God made with Moses at Mount Sinai in that day, at the time of the Exodus, and later the promise that God made to King David generations later. These are hundreds of years apart, and yet they're all part of one single purpose that God has in mind for the Jewish people. God said, I will be their God and they will be my people, with respect to the seed of Abraham. 400 years pass, I guess it is, I think. 400 years pass, God's done absolutely nothing. But then comes the Exodus, and God takes Moses aside and basically says, Moses, remember that promise I made to Abraham? I'm going to do that now. I'm going to do that thing now. I said that I'll be their God and they will be my people, and I've been busy. but now I'm going to become their God, and I'm going to make them my people. And the Mosaic Covenant was nothing more and nothing less than God defining the terms with Israel, striking a contract with Israel, dictating the terms of what that relationship that he promised to Abraham was going to look like. Here's what it's going to look like when I'm your God and you're my people. You're going to do this for me, and I'm going to do this for you. Okay? You want to sign on? And ostensibly, they signed on, but not really, not in their heart. They never really in their heart signed on. But at least with respect to their representative Moses, the agreement was struck. And the terms of that agreement have never been rescinded. that still stands as a perpetual contract. That's the language that is used in that context, an everlasting covenant that God made with the people of Israel such that it still stands. If you will keep your side of the bargain, I will keep my side of the bargain. So now we have the promise to Abraham. We have that promise to Abraham given flesh in the covenant that God made with Moses as an everlasting covenant. And then you have a lot happen where Israel didn't keep their part of the bargain, and they look downright heathenish for many, many, many generations. Then along comes David, and God makes a promise with David where he promises that David's throne will endure forever. He will establish his throne forever. Well, what's that all about? Mary, I think, rightly understands that that's connected. The kingship of the son of David is the missing piece of the puzzle about what this relationship is going to look like when God is ruling as their God and they are being the people of God. It's not simply going to be the transcendent God that they worship and serve. God is going to embody his very authority in the form of a human king, of the son of David, of the line of David. And he's going to embody his authority in that king, and that's how they will serve God. They will serve God by serving the king. God will be their God by being their king in human form. And that's the other part of the picture that we wouldn't get if it weren't for the Davidic covenant. But Mary is understanding that to be part of one and the same picture. That's why she can see the fulfillment, that she can speak as if the fulfillment of the Davidic covenant is a fulfillment of the Abrahamic covenant. I mean, notice that's what she's doing here. In accord with what he told our fathers, and that's a reference back to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, he has made Israel his servant in remembrance of his faithfulness to Abraham and his descendants to the end of time. And when is she saying this? At the birth of the son of David, the son of the Most High God. Well, why should there be a connection? Because she sees all the covenants fitting together as a coherent promise, a single promise that came in installments throughout the history of Israel. Now, let me comment on this. He has made Israel his servant, that here in the time of Jesus, he has made Israel his servant. This may not be interesting to some of you, but let me just briefly touch on this anyway. If you look at modern academic New Testament scholars today, to be perfectly honest, I think they come up with some really pretty goofy ideas every now and then. And one of those ideas that I've heard abroad, and I don't actually remember where it comes from, some of you might know, but one of the contentions that modern New Testament scholarship, one of the neat new ideas, novel ideas, that is the key to understanding the Christian faith, is that Jesus just is Israel. That in the minds of the early interpreters of the Christian faith, they decided that Jesus, all the promises that were made to Israel as Israel, were fulfilled in the person of Jesus. And the key interpretive thing that we need to understand if we're going to understand New Testament biblical Christianity, New Testament Christianity, is to understand the Jesus-Israel equation. Well, you can see how something like Mary's statement here could play into that. We have the birth of Jesus, and Jesus is saying with the birth of Jesus, he is making Israel his servant. Well, how could we be making Israel the servant of God by the birth of Jesus, unless, so the reasoning goes, unless Jesus just is Israel? And so it must be Jesus becoming the servant, and Mary is interpreting Jesus becoming the servant as the one, as the representative member of Israel itself, such that Jesus becoming the servant is Israel becoming the servant. The thing that's ironic to me about that is that, you know, Much of my life, I have been rubbing shoulders with fundamentalists. I mean, that's basically my background. That's where I was trained. That's where I was nurtured. And that kind of argument is the sort of argument that you'd hear among fundamentalists. You mean the problem with fundamentalist interpretation of the Bible is it is intelligent, it is creative, without really being subtly, sensitively rational. And what I mean by that is, it's really not paying much attention to what's going on, to read Mary's statement and say, well, this is the birth of Jesus, and he's saying that it's making Israel his servant. Well, I know that makes sense. If we equate Israel and Jesus, that must be it. And just kind of create this assumption that brings coherence to the statement without really thinking about it any further. You know, without really stopping to think, is that what Mary's thinking? Is that really what's going on here? Fundamentalist interpretation is full of those kinds of facile assumptions that get made to bring intelligence and rationality and coherence to the passage without really being sensitive to all the issues involved. What is Mary saying? What makes a whole lot more sense is not that Mary thinks that Jesus is Israel and Israel is Jesus. I mean, why would she think that? That doesn't make any sense. But what makes a whole lot of sense is she's recognizing that because she understands the coherence of the Abrahamic, the Mosaic, and the Davidic covenant, and she understands that they're all part of the same picture, that with the birth of the one who's going to be the king, who's going to rule over Israel for God, with his birth is going to comes the prospects for everything that God promised Abraham to come to pass. It's only a matter of time. And this child is going to grow up. And when this child grows up, he's going to be the deliverer. And he's going to rule as king. And when he rules as king, then everything that God had promised will come to pass. And what did God promise? I will be your God, and you will be my people. Zacharias, in the next statement coming up, is going to spell that out even further. So that we might, without fear, serve God in holiness and righteousness, he's going to say. What does it mean to be the servant of God? It's just simply what God was promising to Abraham when he said, you will be my people. You will be my child. You will be my servant. You as a people will stand in this unique relationship to me. That's what that's what Mary has in mind here. And it just seems to me that reading it that way takes into account the fullness of the background of the Old Testament and the context of Mary's life and situation and the significance of the birth of Jesus in a way that has some subtlety to it and just doesn't require that we just make up a facile assumption to bring coherence to it. I hope that was clear. I mean, and maybe that's irrelevant to you because you don't read those guys anyway, but. Okay, before I go on to the next section then, let me just make one last comment about this. So what is the picture here? The picture is this baby Jesus is going to be born. He is eventually, when he gets old enough, going to be king over Israel. If he's king over Israel, there can't nobody else be king over Israel, including the Romans. So they're going to have to be brought low and scattered. Jesus will be existing in the throne and floating the boat of all of Israel, exalting all of Israel. And the promises that God made to Abraham and to Moses and to David will come to pass. And the people of Israel will serve God in the form of their King Jesus. They will serve him. They will obey him. They will honor him. They will be righteous and holy in their lives. And according to the Mosaic covenant, God will therefore bless them and give them safety and protection from their enemies. As they serve and obey God and keep his commandments. That's Mary's picture. Okay. Did it come about that way? Was Mary just wrong in the picture that she's painting here? Well, it's more complicated than that. On the one hand, everything that Mary is saying is absolutely true. What she's saying is going to come to pass exactly the way she's thinking it's going to come to, well, exactly the way. Yeah. It's going to come about, it's going to come to pass exactly, in accordance with exactly those predictions that she's referring to in this statement. It's going to come to be. It hasn't yet, I would argue, it hasn't yet come to pass, but it will one day. I got lost in my own sentence. What was I talking about? Okay, but Mary has a particular mental picture, a particular mental image of what this is going to look like, and we are in a position of history to know that mental picture was wrong. I mean, actually what happened is Jesus didn't end up on the throne in exactly the way that Mary was picturing it. He ended up crucified on the cross and therefore up on a different throne than the one she had in mind, the one next to the right hand, at the right hand of God on high, rather than sitting there in Palestinian real estate. He wasn't on that throne. He was on the other throne. Mary, I don't think, understands that in this statement that she's making here. She still has some kind of picture of this being an imminent historical reality in the geopolitics of the world. Jesus is going to become a human ruler here pretty soon when he gets old enough. I'm quite certain that's what she's envisioning here. How are we to understand that then? In view of, if you're someone like me who believes in the inerrancy of the scripture, how is it inerrant that we have recorded here Mary's sentiments about what the significance of Jesus' birth is, and it doesn't go down that way? Here's how I would think about that. I think it's important that we make a distinction between the verbal intent of somebody, and I don't know what to call it, but the psychological expectations of someone. Those are two entirely different things. What does Mary intend to do in this statement? What Mary intends to do in this statement is to draw our attention back to, draw our minds back to what it was that the Old Testament actually promised. She's not telling us anything in these statements that hasn't already been said by the prophets in one way or another, in one form or another. So she's not giving us anything new. She's just reminding us, remember the promise that was made to Abraham, remember the promise that was made to David, remember the promises that were made to Israel in the time of Moses. Jesus being born is the fulfillment of all those things. I mean, when you get right down to it, that's the essence of what Mary is communicating here. Not really anything more and not really anything less. Now, her psychological expectations that go along with that is that Jesus is going to fulfill all of his predictions in this particular way. And I think she probably has a sort of a picture in mind about how that's going to look when Jesus fulfills all these things. But her psychological expectations, her psychological picture of how it's going to look is not really essentially a part of what she's communicating with her words. Now, how would I explain that? If you were to go back and were to interview Mary and were to say, "Hi, Mary, my name is Jack. I'm from the 21st century. I've got a few questions for you. Let me fill you in a little details about how history went here and, you know, what went down. I just wanted to be clear that in Luke 1, when you said what you said, did you mean to suggest that when Jesus got to be 21 years old, the Roman emperor would be deposed and Jesus would be king over the people of Israel, in that real estate, in history, and so on and so forth, and lay out the picture for her. Explain the issues, explain the problems, explain the nature of the complexity of the question. How would Mary respond? Now, I'm arguing that if Mary would respond, "Yep, I meant to say that Jesus was going to be there when he was 21 on the throne and the Roman honky was going to be dead. That's what I meant to say." Well, if that's what she meant to say, then she would be wrong. I mean, then we have to just simply acknowledge that that's an error. That's a mistake. She had a fallacious understanding of how this was all going to go down, and she's wrong. But if Mary would have the savvy to say, "Well, I have to confess, in all honesty, that is what I was expecting to be the way that it would go down. I was expecting that. But really, all I had in mind is I knew what had been promised to Abraham, and I knew what had been promised to Moses, and I knew what had been promised to David, and I knew that Gabriel said, my child was the one. And so all I can really say that I was saying is I was rejoicing in the fact, and I was glorying in the fact that my child was going to fulfill all that God had actually promised those people throughout the ages. In all honesty, that's all I was saying. And if I was wrong in how that was going to look, then I guess I was wrong in how that was going to look. But what did I know? And therefore, it wasn't strictly speaking part of her what I would call verbal intent that she was necessarily intending to communicate any particular picture of how it was going to look. Rather, it was the fact that Jesus was the fulfillment of these promises that was her primary intent. And in that regard, I would contend she was not wrong. She did not make a mistake, and she was not in error. As history, unless I'm wrong, which is very possible, but unless I'm wrong, history is going to play this out. And in the end, we are going to see that everything Mary said is the significance of Jesus' birth, is in fact the significance of Jesus' birth. It took a little longer than she had anticipated. It didn't quite meet her picture of how it was going to be fulfilled. But all she's claiming is that it's going to be fulfilled by this person, by this individual. And that's true. And she was absolutely right about that. Okay. Let me just go a little bit further then into the next unit. We're running out of time, so I won't get into Zacharias' comment, but let me get right up to Zacharias' prophecy, and then we'll pick up his prophecy next week. Now the scene shifts. Mary has stayed with Elizabeth about 3 months, which puts Elizabeth in her ninth month now, in the ninth month of her pregnancy, so she's within a month of delivering. But Mary goes home. Mary returns to Nazareth. In the meantime, Luke keeps us in Elizabeth and Zacharias' village in the hill country of Judea. And John is being born now. Now, Elizabeth's pregnancy came to term, and she gave birth to a son. The neighbors and her relatives heard that the Lord had extended his compassion toward her, and they rejoiced with her. Now, as it happened, they came to circumcise the child on the eighth day. Now, they started to name him after the name of his father, Zacharias, but his mother reacted and said, no, he shall be named John instead. But they said to her, there is no one among your relatives who is called by that name. And through gestures, they inquired to his father what name he wanted to call him. I'd love to know what those gestures were. How do you communicate that with gestures? And through gestures, they inquired of his father what name he wanted to call him. He asked for a writing tablet and wrote as follows, John is his name. They were all surprised. Then immediately his mouth was opened, including his tongue, and he spoke, praising God. A sense of apprehension came upon all their neighbors. Now people kept talking about all these things in all the hill country of Judea. Everyone who heard about these things formed the question in his own mind, what then will this child be? For the hand of the Lord was certainly with him. Okay, this is a very straightforward, there's not much to say about this count. The baby's born. 8 days later is a time, according to the Mosaic law, that you circumcise a son. He's on the eighth day. It comes time for the circumcision of the son. They have a little ceremony. Evidently, I didn't check this out. I'm just making this assumption. Maybe I'm wrong, but I would assume that because they're naming the child at the same time, that was just part of the custom of that time, is that you christened the child at the same time that you circumcised them. That is, you named them at that time. So, at the circumcision, they're going to name the child. The people running the ceremony are going to name him Zacharias. But Elizabeth interjects, whoa, wait, no, his name will be John. Now, why? Remember when the angel Gabriel appeared to Zacharias, he basically instructed Zacharias to name the child John. And there's two ways you could have taken the angel statement, either as a prediction or as a kind of an imperative, as a kind of instruction, as an order. And here's given Elizabeth's statement here, I'm inclined to think that Elizabeth and Zacharias interpreted as an instruction. And so she wants to follow the instructions of the angel, so she puts a halt to the ceremony, interjects, "Wait, halt, you'll name him John." They're surprised by that because apparently, according to the habits and customs of naming in that time, you named after relatives, and they don't have any relatives named John, so it would be highly unusual for them to introduce a new name into the family line. So they can't quite get over that. I mean, that's just an interesting little side note, how strong custom is in our lives, in our existence as human beings. Has nothing to do with right and wrong, has nothing to do with morality, but our sense of propriety is so sensitive to just what we're familiar with. Ultimately, we got to get over that. We have to be able to transcend culture and familiarity and patterns and customs, because they will only in the end trap us in unbelief and untruth and falsehood if we're not sensitive to that. I mean, not that there's anything wrong with these people, but it just... You know, they're surprised. I mean, this is just this shocking, almost outrageous thing that they want to name him John. So they decide, well, we got to get Zacharias permission for this. I mean, this is just outrageous. So they have to somehow communicate with John. John writes on a writing tablet, his name is John. They're surprised at Zacharias' response, but Zacharias is simply being obedient to the instructions of the angels. And immediately, just as the angel had predicted, and after naming the child John, his mouth is opened, his tongue is set free, whatever that means. Whether that means the tongue was literally frozen or whether that's a metaphor, I don't know. But whatever was supernaturally blocking his ability to speak was now removed, and he was now once more free to speak again. And their response is a sense of apprehension, it says. Why apprehension? I think, again, just because when something as grand as what's happening here begins, when you're confronted with something this grand, this weighty, this heavy, this significant, you can't help but be intimidated by it. We're in the presence of something a whole lot bigger than me. I think it's easy to lose sight of what's going on here because, again, if we don't pay attention in our study of the scripture, and if we allow ourselves to be too much affected by modern Christian culture and its expectations, we lose sight of the fact that in the Bible, miracles are not normal, they are abnormal, they are unusual. I mean, I think a lot of people, if without really thinking about it, would say, oh, man, the Bible is chock full of miracles on every page. Well, not so. Now, prove me wrong if I'm wrong here. I'm partly going by memory. But it seems to me that the miracles come in clusters around huge, significant events in God's purposes. There's a cluster of miracles around the Exodus. That's where God pulled out all the stops. There's a cluster of miracles around Elijah and Elisha, smack dab in the middle of the prophetic period. And then there's a cluster of miracles around Jesus and the apostles, and that's pretty much it. I mean, there's scattered things where God in his mercy does amazing supernatural things as acts of kindness and so on to people. But for the most part, God is behind the veil. For the most part, God remains hidden and invisible to mankind. He doesn't break through and scream, "Here I am. I'm the author of all reality. I can do whatever I want. Here I am." For the most part, he doesn't do that. But there have been those moments in history where he's broken through so there can be no doubt, "I'm the boss. I'm the author. I'm in control. I do whatever I want to do whenever I want to do it. And there's nobody stopping me." But it's happened primarily clustered around those three periods in history. Well, this is the beginning of that third period. These people have lived their whole lives and never seen a miracle. And all of a sudden, this guy claims to have been visited by an angel in the holy place in the temple. Yeah, right. I mean, did you see the angel? I didn't see the angel. They're probably skeptical. Something happened, sure. And this guy has been rendered speechless, yeah. But, you know, I've never seen an angel in my whole life. This probably didn't really happen. There's probably a certain amount of skepticism. But Zacharias has communicated something of what the angel has said. Part of what the angel has said is, when the child is born, then when these things come to pass, you'll speak again, however he puts that, when these things have come to pass. Well, the last thing that has to come to pass is the naming of this child, John. He names the child John, and he can speak again. And I think if I were one of those semi-skeptical neighbors of Zacharias, I would have gone, whoa, this is for real. It came about just as he said the angel said it would come about. This is for real. This is exactly what he said it was. This really was an angelic visitation. This really is a child, a promise. This really is an event that is the beginning of one of the most important parts in our periods of our history as a people. Well, I mean, I'd get tingles up my spine as well. And that's, I think, what he's saying. A sense of apprehension came upon all of their neighbors. And then he makes this parenthetical comment that I think is out of the chronology. This is Luke interjecting this into the chronology of the account. That's why I put it in parentheses, where Luke just simply comments that these were remarkable events that became evening conversations among all the people of the region. And the question on everyone's mind was, what is this child going to be? For the hand of the Lord was certainly with him. They were now persuaded that this was for real. God had spoken. God had acted. This is an unusual child. And they were waiting to see what this child could possibly be. Okay, I'll leave it there and open it up to your questions or comments.
Just very quickly, Jack, I wanted to... Maybe this clarification is not necessary, because you really did say what you meant to say, I think. But when you're talking about the potential problem of what Mary said, whether, you know, her belief about how it was going to come about and so forth, I just wanted to, I mean, you said this, but I wanted to clarify it. You kept using these modifiers, like what primarily she meant or fundamentally or something like this, which I could imagine someone who believed in what used to be discussed as limited inerrancy using that kind of language, that, yeah, okay, she got some details wrong, but she had the main idea. That's not what you're saying.
Right.
What you're saying is that everything she said was true. I mean, if you look at her statements, every one of her statements was true. We could separate that out from her beliefs, perhaps, or speculations as to how those things would come about. But nowhere did she assert, my beliefs about this are true.
Right.
What she asserted is, this is going to happen. And she may have been, and probably did, have a picture that was not totally accurate about how it was happening, but she never said how it was going to happen. So that's what you were getting at, right?
Yeah, exactly. Okay. And we'll see as we go through the Gospel of Luke how the gap between what Mary knows and what Mary might expect is a gap that is in the minds of most of the people that Jesus is going to confront throughout his ministry. And that tension is what creates a problem of plausibility. If you're the Messiah, how come you don't look like the Messiah? And that's going to create a real tension for them.
I might just say, it occurred to me on the problem of making signs to him about the name. He's not deaf. I mean, they can talk to him. What you do when you're talking to somebody who can't talk is you make signs to indicate to them how they can answer you. Like,
right.
you want it to be Zacharias, right? Or something like that, you know.
Good point. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, that's right. I forget he's not deaf.
Pardon me if I missed this. About Mary.
Uh-huh.
She seems to be in a situation where she's more than just a well-informed teenager giving a rational response. Her response seems to be one that's inspired by the Spirit of God. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, that's true.
Mm-hmm. Okay, just wanted to clarify that.
Well, I mean,
elaborate, please. Yeah.
It's a little bit more complicated in that she is a well. And what I'm saying is, for the moment, here is an episode where Mary is a really astute, well-informed teenager. What else did you put?
Providing a rational response.
Yeah, providing a rational response. But there's a supernatural clarity here that makes its way into her assertions. And there are no guarantees that she's going to be just as clear tomorrow as she is today, is what I'm saying. So that I think is the episodic and inspirational character to this event and the statement that she makes in this event. It's the statement, I think, that is, I think you could truly say it's an inspired statement. But what I was working really hard to do is to make a distinction between an inspired statement in the sense in which this is and an inspired statement in the sense of which Isaiah might get revelation from God, where he says, "Thus saith the Lord, the Babylonians are going to knock your block off." Well, that's brand new information, and information that there's no way in the world anybody on earth would know if God had not revealed this new information to the prophet. Mary is not giving us any new information that we don't already have, but she has just recognized, put all the pieces together in a particularly clear way, and is speaking out of that clarity, making an inspired statement out of that clarity. It's much like Peter when he says, "You are the Messiah." Peter, or who do you say that I am? Peter says, "You are the Christ, the Son of the living God," or whatever it is he says. And Jesus says, "Flesh and blood has not revealed this to you, but your Father in heaven." Peter was clear at that moment in time, and Jesus recognizes the supernatural clarity of his claim there. But we know from the rest of the account, Peter didn't remain that clear all the time. You know, he was downright stupid at times in his expectations and how he put all that together and how he understood that. So.
Great. Thanks.
I have a question about your translation.
Okay.
I don't know if you have your Greek up there with you, but in most of our English translations, in verse 54, it says, "He has given help to Israel, his servant." And your translation, as far as I can tell, doesn't have any word that represents that idea of giving help. It just says he made Israel his servant. And I haven't looked closely at the Greek, but it sure looks like there's a word that should be translated something like give help.
So are you on my
17? Yeah, the last sentence in your section 17.
Okay. Yeah, I decided that it's one Greek, I've translated the word that they translate give help to as, I have to go back and look at my notes. Let me come back and look at my notes. But
sure.
I've decided to render that Greek word differently than they have. It's antilambano, and they've translated that to give help to. I don't think they're right about that in this context. So, but I'll look at my notes and see why I didn't think so.
Thank you.
Jack, on the question about Mary, and when she's talking about he has scattered abroad those who thought they were important in the outlook of their hearts, he has brought down rulers from their thrones and exalted the lowly.
Mm-hmm.
With that, you went with the idea that she was talking about the Babylonian, Persian, and then Greek kingdoms, and then ultimately the Roman kingdom.
Yeah, and primarily she has in mind the Romans of her own day. But because she's recognized that this faithfulness extended from generation to generation, it looks to me like she has recognized that God's protective hand has been keeping the stage set for the fulfillment of his promises throughout their entire history.
So could it be also a possibility, because that's like you packed a lot into that as to what's is in her mind, which makes her incredibly aware and intelligent and sophisticated in my mind, because a lot of people even today wouldn't pick up on that being all packed in there in those words. So that's kind of one question. How much of that is supernatural clarity, in your opinion? My second question related to that phrasing is, which would kind of take away from the propheticness of it, would put it in a real different mindset, which is, does she even have to be thinking of the Roman situation at all, which is putting in her culture interpretation? Could she just be thinking of the history based on the fact that she talked about the people who were just coming to clarity on that, and perhaps she could have been hearing that teaching herself, which you were saying that the fundamentalists don't even have that down right now in terms of seeing these historic events and covenants being connected. So maybe she wasn't making that leap yet herself either, because in her own time and culture, they're just starting to put that together themselves. And that's part of her supernatural clarity here, and maybe using her own culture's knowledge at the time. Am I making myself clear at all?
So is the essence of your question, is part of the supernatural clarity that she's for the first time seeing something that she had not and would not have seen earlier, apart from the spirit
well,
of prophecy?
Well, does that have to even be supernatural clarity? Because you made the statement about in her time, there's a group of people, you just kind of mentioned it briefly, that were putting this together.
What I mean by that group of people, it's not like I have any independent knowledge of that, but apparently Elizabeth, Zacharias, and Mary, they're speaking as if we all know what we're talking about here, it seems to me. So I don't know how widespread that is, but we're at least dealing with a pocket of people who seem to have grasped that.
Or maybe that's where the supernatural is coming in.
It could be. Yeah, it could be. And I don't know. I mean, I would have to be there to be able to answer that for sure, whether or not this is just absolutely brand new, life-changing clarity in putting all the pieces together, or whether it's something they'd been talking about over time. I don't know. The important thing for our purposes is they have given expression to that coherence in a way that makes sense out of the coherence of the events of the birth of John the Baptist and Jesus and the whole history of Israel and the covenants God made with them. That's what's important for our purposes. I have no reason to doubt that they could have already been hammering this stuff out in conversation. And so they had pretty fixed expectations. And what's become clear to them is what Gabriel is saying is these children are the key players in the fulfillment of these events that you have been hammering out in your understanding. Mm-hmm. Now, I don't know if that answers all your questions.
That's okay. We can talk more about it.
Okay. I don't think it's that much, the other part of your question, I don't know that it's that much for Mary to understand. I mean, she uses rulers plural, and that's what makes me think that she doesn't have in mind just simply Caesar. You've brought Caesar down and you've raised up whatever. She talks about rulers, and she's just mentioned your Hesed for generations and generations. But you brought down rulers, you have scattered them abroad, and you have brought down rulers or those who think they're important. And what I'm saying, and maybe I'm wrong about this, but what I'm saying is I think the reason she's using plural is because she's recognizing this event that we can anticipate here is just one in a string of people that you're bringing down in order to raise up this one. The three other kingdoms that coexist, you mean Parthia? Oh, I see what you're saying. Okay, well, no, but see, what's key to the way I'm taking this, and maybe I'm wrong, but what's key to the way that I'm taking this is what Mary is saying here is the promised birth of this child is the giving of good things to those who lack and the sending away empty those who are rich. The birth of this child is going to be the scattering of the rulers and bringing low those who thought they were something in the attitude of their heart. I think it's the birth of the child that is the end of those things, whereas Babylonia, Persia, and Greece have been long gone at this point. But this child is spelling the scattering of the rulers abroad. That's how I'm understanding what she's saying.
Kind of two questions. One is culturally, which you probably know the answer to, is I always thought it was kind of strange that Mary would spend 3 full months with her cousin when she herself is pregnant. That's one question. And the second is, which I know you'd have to project on, but isn't it a little bit odd that God's working these miracles with cousins rather than someone that maybe isn't related biologically?
I don't know how to answer that. I mean, it's striking. Yeah. I don't know what to do with it beyond just be struck by it, though. I don't know. I'm speechless. And with respect to the custom, too, I don't know that either. I don't know enough about their everyday life and their patterns of maternity and so on to know what you would and wouldn't expect. I imagine they could take care of each other. And they would have servants, maybe. I don't know. Probably they wouldn't have servants. They probably weren't wealthy enough for that. One more.
I was thinking over that same question about Mary having that knowledge, trying to figure that out. And I came up with an analogy that made sense to me. In American culture, there's no unifying identity. But if you think of like a 16-year-old Palestinian Arab girl, you know, who is in a culture that has a much more politicized and historical religious identity, you know, she would be very aware of all of these things that were going on.
Political implications of.
Right. And so, you know, if there's something in the Quran that's alike to these promises, you know, and an angel came to her and told her this, she would be very aware of, you know, the history behind that and also the implications for, you know, the current political situation.
Right, right. Yeah, exactly. A good point. And that's the way I'm seeing this, is that it's not like this is not known among the people of that time, that there is an expectation among some of them that the Messiah will come one day. And they already know the implications of that. At least they think they know the implications of that. And along with that would come certain expectations, a certain picture of what that's going to look like, what the liberation is going to look like. As we go into Zacharias, he's going to talk about liberation, deliverance, a lot of loaded, I think, political language. And we'll look at that next week. I've kept you over. Here you go.